Hi, this is Ruth McCauley with news from the Decatur area for Thursday, December 1st. We begin with a front page article from the Herald and Review on public safety. Police spare the razors to help kids with disabilities. This is an article written by Huey Freeman. If the woolly worms are fuzzier than normal, that could mean it will be a cold winter. If cops have fuzzier faces in November, that means families with children suffering from severe illnesses are going to get help. For the fourth straight year, law enforcement officers in Macon County paid a fee to grow their beards as part of a unique charitable project. About 200 officers and civilian employees of the Decatur Police Department and Macon County Sheriff's Office took part in No Shave November, which benefited six families. "It's a time we let our hair down, let our beards grow," said Decatur Police Chief Jim Getz at a ceremony at headquarters. "Most of us have kids or no kids. When we see kids in need, it hits home with us. We like to help out when we can." This is the second year for Decatur Police to take part in the project, initiated in 2013 by the Sheriff's Office. Brandy Smith, 26, has been caring for her six-month-old son, Rowan, who was born 11 weeks premature, weighing less than 3.5 pounds at birth. Since spending the first 77 days of his life in intensive care at HSHS St. John's Hospital in Springfield, Rowan has been kept at home around the clock, except for doctor appointments, until the ceremony Wednesday morning. He was born with a congenital heart defect and lung disease, Smith said. Four therapists come to their Decatur home regularly. Rowan also began seeing an eye doctor because of trouble with his eyesight. "Not a week goes by without a doctor's appointment, sometimes two doctor's appointments," Smith said as she held Rowan in her arms. The family was nominated to receive help by Smith's mother-in-law, Lori Robertson. "I think it's amazing," Smith said. "I didn't know the police do stuff like this. I think it is really nice of them to do this." Paula McMahon was at the police station with her 2-year-old son, Lucky, who suffers from hydrocephalus, excessive fluid on the brain, which was diagnosed before his birth. He spent 65 days after his birth in the intensive care unit at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana. He has had more than a dozen surgeries, including reconstruction of his head at Medical City Dallas Hospital in Texas. "He has a shunt and a gastrointestinal tube," McMahon said. "He has eating and swallowing issues." The police were informed of Lucky's plight by Michelle Oberheim, children's minister at Northwest Christian Church, where McMahon attends. "I think it is a wonderful program," McMahon said. "I am just surprised someone recognized children with disabilities and helped us out." Sheriff Thomas Schneider said each law enforcement agency focused on helping three families this year. "Every opportunity we can see to get back to the community in some way, we are going to do it," Schneider said. "We are looking at different ways to help the community." Getz said he opened up the program to all department employees this year, each of whom paid $30 to participate. Instead of focusing on facial hair, female officers wore special headbands to signify their support. Civilian staff members wore jeans. Dispatchers came to work wearing colors of their favorite teams. "We've got people that didn't take advantage of not shaving or wearing blue jeans," Getz said. "They just donated the money." The program is available to families who qualify all year. The Decatur Police donated to three families at its first ceremony last year, eight more since then, including Wednesday's beneficiaries. "We receive phone calls throughout the year," Getz said. "If we think the family is deserving, we will help them out." The Sheriff's Office is extending into No Shave December to support Toys for Tots, a program administered by the Marine Corps Reserve. Already, 52 employees have signed up to participate. "We are looking for a way to give to the kids for Christmas," said Sheriff Sergeant Ron Atkins. Our next article also appears on the front page of the Herald and Review. It was written by Jared Jarman, a Lee News Service writer, and this article comes out of Charleston. Eastern expects state money to plug operations. Eastern Illinois University's latest influx of expected stopgap funding is intended to assist operations through the rest of the year. Last week, it was reported that the Illinois Board of Higher Education is intending to funnel $17 million of the $20 million they received from the state's stopgap funding measure in June to three state institutions, including Eastern. Eastern was apportioned to get almost $5.6 million, 33% of the $17 million, by the end of the year. As previously reported, the funding can only be used to pay down costs incurred this year. The majority of the funds were allocated to Western Illinois University with $8.3 million of the pot, about 50%. The Higher Education Board determined the money would be allocated to these institutions after they had proven they were in a state of financial emergency. To be in a state of financial emergency, the university had to demonstrate that it is significantly diminishing all available resources and must satisfy any other factors determined appropriate by the board, according to state law. According to board documents, the money was allocated based on payroll and enrollment, among other factors. When the funds will be received by Eastern is unclear, as the money will be coming from the State General Revenue Fund, which has a backlog of bills totaling $10.6 billion. Wow. Pardon me. In addition to the $5.6 million, Eastern is still expected to get the remaining $1.3 million from the state as part of the $26.2 million stopgap funding they were appropriated in the summer, Vice President for Business Affairs Paul McCann said. Eastern also has tuition dollars coming in to help offset regular operation costs incurred. McCann said that approximately $35 million is brought in from fall semester tuition and $30 million from spring semester tuition. McCann noted Eastern will be able to operate throughout the budgetary impasse. We are pleased to have received the monies from IBHE, McCann said. Along with other institutions in the state, Eastern has been getting piecemeal funding while the state legislature and Governor Bruce Rauner still disagree over reforms and budgeting. The state legislature has yet to pass a budget not vetoed by Rauner after more than a year. The university has remained a major advocate to budget specifically a full budget as opposed to the stopgap funding that has come in. EIU President David Glassman said in board meetings that the university simply needs predictable funding, even if it is through stopgap-like funding measures. If we knew we were going to get X amount, and it is going to come at this point, that would be much, much better than what we have now, Glassman said. At least then we would know what our budget is. Currently, the EIU Board of Trustees has only approved a preliminary budget because of the uncertainties at the state level. We're putting placeholders here because this is what we anticipate, because that's what we've been led to anticipate. But you don't know until it happens, Glassman said. This just has all of the universities handcuffed. McCann said EIU leaders remain strong advocates of full funding for Illinois public higher education, but will continue to work with the stopgap funding until a complete budget is enacted. All of the state's universities have advocated together in the past for full and predictable funding. We all want predictable and stable funding, Glassman said. That is what we want. We are trying to plan at EIU or whatever university you are at, and when you don't know what you are working with, it is hard to strategically plan. As these financial challenges brought on by the state loom, Eastern has been doing ongoing work on an internal review, particularly of its future, through the Vitalization Project. The recommendations from those involved in the project are expected to be finalized soon. Most of the reports from the working groups involved in the project are due by December 15th to the university president. Still sticking with the front page, this is an article from Springfield written by Dan Petrella, who's the H&R Springfield Bureau Chief. Exelon bill ready for vote, Rauner okays changes. After months of negotiations and a series of amendments in recent weeks, a proposed energy policy overhaul from Exelon Corporation that would keep open the company's financially struggling Clinton and Quad Cities nuclear power plants appears poised for a vote. The final pieces of the agreement fell into place Wednesday, with Governor Bruce Rauner's office signing off on a series of new provisions that would cap rate increases for residential, commercial, and industrial energy customers. However, subsidies to keep open the two downstate nuclear power plants remains at the heart of the package, along with other policy and rate changes designed to increase investment in renewable power and energy efficiency. If the bill is approved in the House today, it would move to the Senate for a final vote. Exelon has said it will take steps toward shutting down the Clinton plant on June 1st if lawmakers don't approve the bill during their fall veto session, which is scheduled to end today. The two plants together employ about 1,500 full-time workers and generate millions of dollars in local property tax revenue. State Representative Linda Chapa Livia, a Democrat of Aurora, chairwoman of the House Energy Committee, praised the bill's sponsor, State Representative Bob Rita, a Democrat of Blue Island, for bringing together energy companies, environmental groups, business interests, and consumer advocates in an attempt to reach a compromise. I've said all through these proceedings that no one's going to get 100% of what they want, Chapa Livia said. Indeed, in deference to consumer advocates, including the Illinois Attorney General's office, a controversial proposal to change the way customers are charged for the power was removed. To maintain the support of environmental groups who backed the package's increased investment in renewable power and energy efficiency, a provision that would have subsidized Dynegy-owned coal plants in southern Illinois was jettisoned. The last major change, which the House committee approved Wednesday evening, added caps on rate increases for energy users, from heavy industry to individual households. Susan Satter, Public Utilities Counsel for the Attorney General's Office, said her agency needed more time to review those provisions to ensure they would adequately protect consumers. The Illinois Public Interest Research Group, a consumer advocacy organization, also said the rate caps deserve more scrutiny. There is no reason that such massive and complicated policy change should be rushed through the legislative process, Abraham Scar, the group's director, said. In energy policy, the devil is in the details, and small details have profound impacts for millions of people for years to come. Meanwhile, the Illinois Manufacturers Association, the Chemical Industry Council of Illinois, and other large energy users also remain opposed. However, other business groups, including Illinois Retail Merchants Association, support the proposal. In exchange for subsidies, which Exelon says are justified because, like subsidized wind and solar energy, nuclear power plants produce no climate-damaging carbon pollution, the bill guarantees that the Clinton and Quad Cities plants would remain open for another 10 years. Officials with Exelon subsidiary Commonwealth Edison estimated the entire package would result in an average monthly bill increase of less than 25 cents for residential customers in northern Illinois over a 13-year period. The new amendment would cap the increase at that level. Ameren Illinois, meanwhile, estimated that its residential customers would see a 12-cent increase on average. The average increase over the 13-year period would be capped at 35 cents for Ameren customers. We turn inside now to pick up some of the more local news, and our first is out of the Crime and Courts column, written by Huey Freeman, H&R staff writer. Arrest made in drug deal shooting. Police arrested Kyle Smith Merriweather, 22, of Decatur, for allegedly shooting a man he had lured to meet him for a drug deal. He's being held in the Macon County Jail on $250,000 bond on preliminary charges of attempted murder and armed robbery. He is due in court for his arraignment by Wednesday. I'm assuming that's next Wednesday. About 10:15 p.m. November 19th, police were sent to Decatur Memorial Hospital to investigate two men who entered the emergency room seeking treatment for gunshot wounds. Smith Merriweather suffered an abdominal wound. A 32-year-old Decatur man suffered life-threatening wounds with injuries to his left shoulder, armpit, left hip, and left buttock. Officers attempted to interview Smith Merriweather, however, he refused to give a statement, said a probable cause affidavit by Decatur Police Detective James Atkinson. The victim told police he was driven to West Marietta and North Dunham Streets by a woman in her Buick to buy marijuana. When she parked her car, a man approached on foot. While sitting in the front passenger seat of the Buick, he produced $175 to pay for the cannabis, the victim told police. The black male pulled out a small chrome handgun, pointed it at him, and said something like, "You know what this is." The victim grabbed the gun, and the two men struggled for control. The victim was pulled out of the car through an open door. During the struggle, the victim was shot in his arm or abdomen, he told police. At one point, Smith Merriweather dropped the gun. The victim retrieved it and shot him once. Then the victim ran from the scene and was shot in the leg as he ran. He fell to the ground. He was then driven to the hospital by the woman who drove him to the scene. A witness reported that Smith Merriweather walked up to the car, entered the rear passenger side door, and sat down behind the victim. Smith Merriweather handed a bag of cannabis to the driver, which was handed to the victim. The victim reached into his pocket to retrieve money. Smith Merriweather pulled out a firearm and said something like, "Yeah, you know what it is." The victim exited the Buick and was shot. The two men struggled over the gun. Smith Merriweather continued firing the gun into the victim's lower body, the witness told police. After three gunshots, the witness saw the victim fall to the ground. Smith Merriweather continued to shoot as he approached the victim. Smith Merriweather then ran toward his nearby Marietta Street residence while carrying a gun. Police found a silver-colored 380 caliber handgun in the roadway near the intersection. The handgun had damage consistent with being struck by a round from another firearm. Hey, that's a mess. Okay, our next article, also written by Huey Freeman, a little more upbeat. Judge Stedman hangs up robe after decades of service. Circuit Judge Timothy Stedman has retired from service in the courthouse after a span of 35 years in which he presided at many of the county's most high-profile trials after prosecuting thousands of cases. At a retirement party attended by dozens of lawyers, judges, and courthouse employees Wednesday, Stedman said he was mainly going to miss the outstanding people he has worked with since he joined the staff of the Macon County State's Attorney's Office in 1981. "I've been the lucky one," Stedman said in response to comments from presiding judge A.G. Weber. "How lucky we have been for the past 20 years to have him here," Weber said, adding that Stedman is the best role model for judges because he is knowledgeable, diligent, even-handed, and especially patient. He has all the virtues of what to look for in a judge. Dan Flannel, chief judge of the Sixth Circuit, said Stedman's retirement is, quote, "a huge loss to the circuit," end quote. When a judge was needed to take over duties in Piatt County, Stedman volunteered, serving as presiding judge in Monticello for the past 13 months, in addition to duties in Macon County. "He is truly one of the good guys, a hard worker who is well respected, with a great sense of humor," Flannel said. Stedman, a native Southside Chicagoan, landed his job in Decatur right out of John Marshall Law School. After 14 years as a prosecutor, including three in Champaign County, Stedman was elected by circuit judges as an associate Macon County judge in 1995. His wife, Robin, was working as a court reporter in courtroom 3B when he received the news, which would later become her husband's courtroom. "I remember him bebopping in and looking at me and said, 'I got it,'" she recalled. "I was so excited. I knew he would have a long judicial career." She recalled that during his interview for the position, in which he was competing with about 25 applicants, after his 10 minutes were up, he asked for more time, saying, "Don't I get to do my closing argument?" He was originally planning to return to Chicago, but after meeting Decatur court reporting student Robin Gordon through mutual friend Jack Ahola, and subsequently marrying her, he settled in central Illinois. Now their daughter, Katie, is studying to be a court reporter. Stedman said having a lot of courtroom experience helped him to adjust to the bench, but it was still stressful at times, such as when he presided over two infant murder trials within a short time period. But altogether, he has enjoyed his profession. "I looked forward to going there every day," Stedman said. "A lot of times they were important cases, which get your adrenaline going. Every day was something new, something interesting." Our next article is written by Valerie Wells, who's an H&R staff writer. This from Decatur. Decatur superintendent search underway. The Decatur Board of Education met with representatives of Hazard Young, Atea, and Associates during a work session on Wednesday to map out a timeline for choosing the district's next superintendent. Paul Swanson and Bill Atea suggested an aggressive timeline to get a new superintendent hired by early April. "We suggest a workshop with the new superintendent to lay out expectations," Atea said, "and be clear what you want to see delivered to the community and the district." Board President Sherry Perkins will be the designated spokeswoman to the media during the search, though Atea also suggested keeping candidates' names out of the news until one has been hired. Board member T.J. Jackson had originally suggested a forum with finalists to allow the community to question and meet those finalists, but said he was willing to abide by Atea's advice. Instead, the community will have its chance to weigh in on the specific characteristics of a superintendent and bring up the strengths and challenges in Decatur schools at the beginning of the search in forums. Atea suggested, and the board agreed, to meetings with representatives of community segments such as business, faith, elected officials, realtors, service clubs, and so forth, with an open forum included to allow the community a chance to speak to the search firm. Board member B.A. Butts said he thinks one group whose opinions should be sought and considered separately from the rest of the groups is parents whose children attend Decatur schools. After all, they're the ones we serve, he said. Atea and the board members agreed, and Atea said his firm's tabulating software is able to rank responses to surveys and results of forums for up to six groups separately. A page on the Decatur School District's website will be dedicated to the superintendent's search with a survey for the community, updates on forum dates, and links to the firm's webpage, as well as an application form for candidates. Because the last superintendent search was in the 2013-2014 school year, a couple of board members asked if all the forums were still necessary. Perhaps some of the information from that search is still relevant, board member Fred Spanis said. Successful districts pay attention to relationships, Atea said. People need to feel engaged in the process. There's real value in talking to people so they feel engaged and listened to. The first meetings will take place the week of December 12th, including individual meetings between the firm's representatives and the board members. The public forum will also be held that week and will be announced as soon as details are finalized. Let's grab a few local briefs for Thursday, December 1st. The Macon County Health Department will host a Medicare open enrollment event for Medicare Part D from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Tuesday, December 6th, at the department located at 1221 East Condit Street. CHELP, I don't know what that stands for, and Decatur-Macon County Senior Center are also hosting the enrollment. Part D participants must schedule an appointment to attend. Medicare open enrollment will continue through Wednesday, December 7th. For more information or to schedule an appointment, call 217-423-6550. And Workforce Investment Solutions will host a free informational meeting from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, December 6th, in the Illinois WorkNet Center, 757 West Pershing Road, for people who have been laid off and are considering training in a different field. The meeting will explore accelerated training for manufacturing, logistics, truck driving, and healthcare industries. For more information, call 217-875-8750, extension 230, or visit www.worknetdecatur.org. And we're out of time here for the first half hour of news from the Decatur area for Thursday, December 1st. We're going to take a quick break. We hope you can hang on and join us again for the second half hour of news.